So, if you think that would help, HB, thank you.
I've just seen somebody else do this before.
So, for those of you I haven't met, I'm Nick Mahurin, and I'm from Terre Haute, Indiana, relocated here last month, and came for the serenity and nature of the lake with my 170-pound Great Dane, just the two of us out there most of the time, and have really enjoyed the community and the surrounding region as well. So thanks for being such a great community, and thanks for welcoming me to the Rotary Club. I've been in my other Rotary Club for 25 years. I'm a Paul Harris Fellow and a past president, and really learned a lot through programs weekly and about the community and service above self. So congratulations to each of you for what you've done. You clearly have a highly successful club, and it's really impressive. So I thought this might be a fun way to get to know the Cadiz Club a little bit, and for you to get to know a little bit about me. I don't want to hold myself out as an expert on AI, but I think I know more than most, and I kind of enjoy orienting people to it, some things that are surprising. And I've been working on AI at an executive level, not hands-on, but for about 15 years, and I've got 4 patents in the space. So I want to ask a couple of questions just so I know where we're starting. By a show of hands, how many of you know what ChatGPT is? About half. And how many of you use it? Mm-hmm. About half. Good. Okay. Or a little less, maybe. Okay. Good. Well, we'll learn about that and some more things. So this quote is often referenced as an ancient Chinese proverb, and that's unlikely to be true. But more importantly, it isn't a generous wish, but rather a curse. And interestingly, throughout history, of course, when things change rapidly, that's often very difficult for individual humans to cope with. And I think we're entering a time where technology is providing a tremendous number of benefits, and it's also going to provide some significant challenges. So to begin, let's level set on some terms. Here's a word cloud with many of the terms you hear thrown around these days. AI for artificial intelligence, machine learning, algorithms, robotics. And for our purposes today, at a really high level, I think we'll just consider these all synonyms. Even experts toss them around with minimal distinction. In fact, there's one I want to expand on a bit. Many of us remember the depiction of a robotic future in the Jetsons, you know, half a century or so ago. And you might have seen these images from Boston Dynamics that just in the last few years, robots have really been developed to accomplish skilled activities similar to human athletes and so forth. But robotics is a broader term. In fact, most robots are without bodies or any form at all. They're just little pieces of code, and we typically just call those bots. So they're algorithms or bots. Think like a little computer program, but when we say a bot, we mean something that isn't just following a rule set. You know, if Nick is wearing blue, turn the lights on. You know, that's what computer programs have been for most of a century. And today we're talking, when we talk about bots or robotics, we're talking about problem solving. And we're often, when we say AI, as we'll get into, we're really talking about some level of thinking. And the term, when we talk about ChatGPT, that is generative AI, which means it's generating content, not just regurgitating content. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. And I've got a video that I want to show in a few moments. But you could think about this. A bot is really good at things like you're watching YouTube, what to present to you next. They've got billions and billions of videos, right? And their goal is to keep you watching. Like any media, they want to keep you engaged, right? And so a bot will determine based on what it knows about you. And it really isn't just following a rule set. In fact, they can't afford to write a rule set that applies to each one of us. Right, that would require human beings to do, and they need to spend pennies to make these decisions, and they want to spend pennies to make a decision that would be more effective than paying a human dollars to make the decision. So Siri on your iPhone is a personal digital assistant, which is essentially a collection of bots. So this decent baseline definition of what intelligence is might be a good place to really begin the story. This ability to perceive or retain information, perceive information to understand it and retain it, is what some source I found on the internet defines as intelligence. And so when we tack artificial on it, that just means that it wasn't human. It was created. So let's think about something really simple, like how do we perceive or infer? What does a three look like? And if you described this three as best you could to a child or a computer program so that it could perceive other threes, would the description fit these others nicely? It gets a little more challenging when you begin to think about putting hair on it, so to speak. And what about something much more complex, such as a bee? We each recognize these, but consider how different they are from one another. Until recently, only a human brain could do that. And what if we wanted an algorithm to sort through thousands or millions of images to determine which contain a bee and which contain a three? So what does it mean for a machine to learn to be able to do something like that? First, as with robotics, when we say machine, we don't really mean, you know, a machine like a lawnmower or a factory machine. We mean a computer program or algorithm. Something people often say is, and I'm sure I said this decades ago as well, if a computer does it, somebody programmed it to do it. And that is categorically untrue today. It used to be true, but today it is not. Historically, when a computer did something it wasn't programmed to do, we'd call it a bug. Does anybody know where the term bug came from? Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? 20 years ago, I believe that was the first question that was asked for $1 million. And I forget what laboratory it was, but back when computers were as large as this room and they weren't solid state, they had tubes, they went to demonstrate the computer one morning. I think it was about 1944. And it wouldn't work, and it's because a moth had gotten into one of the tubes. So they had to debug the computer. And that's how we ended up with the term. Yeah. All right, so how would you even begin to program software to make a determination as to whether an image contains a B or a 3? So I've got this entertaining video from YouTube that's going to explain how machine learning works. So we said we'd use these as synonyms, but historically, humans have learned best. You know, we're at the top of the food chain, and we don't know of any other species or anything that learns as well as we do. Today, though, we have machines learning, and they are learning with volumes of data that are far greater than any human being's capacity to wrap our minds around. You know, we think about the vast distances across space and time. And if I said, well, hey, one of you, would you watch, I've got 400 million videos I want you to watch and consume that information. You couldn't do it in your lifetime. But a machine can do that. Now, sometimes it takes weeks, months. My people built a model, and ChatGPT is a language model. We built an acoustic model that finished last June, so 13 months ago, that took about 9 months to build. It had 60,000 hours of physician dictation in it. And we got the most capable computers we could afford, tasked them. They ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 9 months to build this model. And we use it day in and day out to decipher physician speech. So, what I want to do here is take you a little bit further. Let me go to this video. Let's see. Yeah, I want to do this now. So I'm going to switch over to another tab. And somebody keep me honest on time. Looks like we have a lot of time. I'm very familiar with the 1 o'clock deadline. Let's see if I've got it. So this, I'm going to do a live demonstration of ChatGPT and some other things in a few moments. And I'd like for us to have a dialogue about the implications of AI, but I thought this would be a really nice opportunity for you to look behind the curtain a little bit about this topic I'm telling you, that AI is not programmed by programmers to follow rules. And the people, including myself, who develop and offer AI honestly don't know how it works. Okay? A little surprising?
On the internet, the algorithms are all around you. You are watching this video because an algorithm brought it to you, among others, to click, which you did, and the algorithm took note. When you open the Tweetbook, the algorithm decides what you see. When you search through your photos, the algorithm does the finding, maybe even makes a little movie for you. When you buy something, the algorithm sets the price, and the algorithm is at your bank watching transactions for fraud. The stock market is full of algorithms trading with algorithms. Given this, you might want to know how these little algorithmic bots shaping your world work, especially when they don't. In ye olden days, humans built algorithmic bots by giving them instructions that humans could explain. If this, then that. But many problems are just too big and hard for a human to write simple instructions for. There's a gazillion financial transactions a second. Which ones are fraudulent? There's octillion videos on NetMeTube. Which 8 should the user see as recommendations? Which shouldn't be allowed on the site at all? For this airline seat, what is the maximum price this user will pay right now? Algorithmic bots give answers to these questions. Not perfect answers, but much better than a human could do. But how these bots work exactly, more and more no one knows. Not even the humans who built them, or built them, as we will see. Now, companies that use these bots don't want to talk about how they work, because the bots are valuable employees. Very, very valuable. And how their brains are built is a fiercely guarded trade secret. Right now, the cutting edge is most likely very, I hope you like linear algebra, but what the current hotness is on any particular site and how the bots work is a bit, I don't know, and always will be. So let's talk about one of the more quaint but understandable ways bots can be built without understanding how their brains work. Say you want a bot that can recognize what is in a picture. Is it a bee or is it a 3? It's easy for humans, even little humans, but it's impossible to just tell a bot in bot language how to do it, because really we just know that's a bee and that's a 3. We can say in words what makes them different, but bots don't understand words, and it's the wiring in our brains that makes it happen anyway. While an individual neuron may be understood and clusters of neurons' general purpose vaguely grasped, the whole is beyond. Nonetheless, it works. So to get a bot that can do this sorting, you don't build it yourself. You build a bot that builds bots and a bot that teaches bots. These bots' brains are simpler, something a smart human programmer can make. The builder bot builds bots, though it's not very good at it. At first, it connects the wires and modules in the bot brains almost at random. This leads to some very special student bots sent to teacher bot to teach.
Cool. Here's my miracle child. So how does your miracle child get cancer? How does that happen?
Sorry for the depressing intermission.
Of course, TeacherBot can't tell a bee from a 3 either. If the human could build TeacherBot to do that, well then, problem solved. Instead, the human gives TeacherBot a bunch of bee photos and 3 photos and an answer key to which is what. TeacherBot can't teach, but TeacherBot can test. The adorkable student bots stick out their tongues, try very hard, but they are bad at what they do. Very, very bad. And it's not their fault, really. They were built that way. Grades in hand, the student bots take a march of shame back to BuilderBot. Those that did best are put to one side, the others recycle. BuilderBot still isn't good at building bots, but now it takes those left and makes copies with changes in new combinations. Back to school they go. TeacherBot teaches, her tests again, and BuilderBot builds again. And again, and again. Now, a builder that builds at random and a teacher that doesn't teach just tests, and students who can't learn, they just are what they are, in theory shouldn't work, but in practice it does. Partly because in every iteration, BuilderBot's slaughterhouse keeps the best and discards the rest, and partly because TeacherBot isn't overseeing an old-timey one-room schoolhouse with a dozen students, but an infinite warehouse with thousands of students. The test isn't 10 questions, but a million questions. And how many times does the test build, test, loop, repeat? As many as necessary. At first, students that survive are just lucky, but by combining enough lucky bots and keeping only what works, and randomly messing around with new copies of that, eventually a student bot emerges that isn't lucky, that can perhaps barely tell bees from threes. As this bot is copied and changed, slowly the average test score rises, and thus the grade needed to survive the next round gets higher and higher. keep this up, and eventually from the infinite warehouse slaughterhouse, a student bot will emerge who can tell a bee from a three in a photo it's never seen before pretty well. But how the student bot does this, neither the teacher bot, nor the builder bot, nor the human overseer can understand, nor the student bot itself. After keeping so many useful random changes, the wiring in its head is incredibly complicated, and while an individual line of code may be understood, and clusters of code's general purpose vaguely grasped, the whole is beyond. Nonetheless, it works. But this is frustrating, especially as the student bot is very good at exactly only the kinds of questions it's been taught to. It's great with photos, but useless with videos, or baffled if the photos are upside down, or things that are obviously not bees, it's confident are. Since TeacherBot can't teach, all the human overseer can do is give it more questions to make the test even longer, to include the kinds of questions the best bots get wrong. This is important to understand. It's a reason why companies are obsessed with collecting data. More data equals longer tests equals better bots. So when you get the Are You Human test on a website, you are not only proving that you are human, hopefully, but you are also helping to build the test to make bots that can read or count or tell lakes from mountains or horses from humans. Seeing lots of questions about driving lately? What could that be building a test for? Now, figuring out what's in a photo or on a sign or filtering videos requires humans to make correct enough tests. But there is another kind of test that makes itself. Tests on the humans. For example, say entirely hypothetical NetMeToo wanted users to keep watching as long as possible. Well, how long a user stays on the site is easy to measure. So TeacherBot gives each student bot a bunch of NetMeToo users to oversee. The student bots watch what their user watches, looks at their files, and do their best to pick the videos that keep the user on the site. The longer the average, the higher their test score. Build, test, repeat. A million cycles later, there's a student bot who's pretty good at keeping the users watching, at least compared to what a human could build. But when people ask, how does the NetMeToo algorithm select videos, once again, there isn't a great answer other than pointing to the bot and the user data it has access to, and most vitally, how the human overseers direct TeacherBot to score the test. That's what the bot is trying to be good at to survive, but what the bot is thinking, or how it thinks it, is not really knowable. All that's knowable is this student bot gets to be the algorithm because it's 0.1% better than the previous bot at the test that humans designed. So everywhere on the internet, behind the scenes, there are tests to increase user interaction, or set prices just right to maximize revenue, or pick the posts from all your friends you'll like the most, or articles people will share the most, or whatever. If it's testable, it's teachable. Well, teachable. And a student bot will graduate from the warehouse to be the algorithm of its domain, at least for a little while. We're used to the idea that the tools we use, even if we don't understand them...
Okay, cute video. And I hope it was digestible. You know, it's not highly technical, but it kind of expanded on this, on the theory behind how bots can be built without kind of understanding them, right? And if you think about it, we've all brought children home, and we just took for granted that they could think, that they could problem solve, they could develop, but we've never had anything else in our lives that was like that until now. And so, interesting to me. So let me move through a few other things. When I asked how many of you had used or heard of ChatGPT, the reason is, to my mind and to a lot of others, the breakthroughs are really nothing short of amazing. I've been building, say, little bots, if you will, little AI, for very specific purposes for, you know, like I said, almost 15 years. But ChatGPT is so generalized. It generates content, and it's just fascinating the amount of information that it has. And we call it generative AI because it does create new information, not just, you know, share with us information that it could find on Google or something. So let me see, I want to go through and I want to explain that, you know, I want to give you like a microcosm, because now we're all seeing like ChatGPT and we can see what it does, but I wanted to provide something that was a little bit more insightful about how and why and what these new understandings are in our world. So one of the first bots or language models, and ChatGPT is a language model that I was building 10 to 15 years ago, was something called a trigram. And so tri, of course, means three. And the idea was to compute how frequently a word appears with two other words around it. So three words. And that's useful in speech recognition because, for example, if I were to speak and play this for a speech recognition application, if I were to say, the sky is glue, G-L-U-E, the sky is glue, that wouldn't make very much sense. And so one of the things that we do with speech recognition is we listen to what we hear, the algorithm does, but it also compares that to what was most likely. So if you dictated into my company's speech recognition engine, the sky is glue, it would almost certainly replace glue with blue because it has a language model in which it would find zero cases of the sky being described as glue, but a proliferation of cases where it's described as blue, and they're sound-alike words. So it would reference, it thought it heard glue, but in generating the word glue, it would create what it calls an n-best list, and it would create all the words that it could possibly be and assign probabilities to them. And then when it went to the language model, it would say, even though that really sounded like glue, the language model is going to override that and put blue in there. Okay. So, and that's what we get frustratingly oftentimes with autocorrect. Right, it's doing something the same. Sometimes autocorrect saves us, and sometimes we're like, "What were you thinking?" Right. So, ChatGPT's language model is so far advanced from those humble beginnings that I can't even tell you how large and complex the model is. In fact, it takes so long that the cutoff date, many of you may know, for the current version of ChatGPT was September of 2021. That tells me when they build a model, it probably takes a year to build it because they came out with this one, over the winter. And so they've got to harvest all the data. Who knows how and where they get all of that. And then they need to compute on it to build the model. I suppose it takes about a year. So what's really fascinating here is very few people thought that something as capable as ChatGPT was right around the corner a year ago. And then it showed up in the fall and just amazed a lot of people. So for those of you who are users, it'll be a little bit redundant. For those of you who haven't used it, I hope a little live demonstration will be kind of interesting and share with you a little bit. So I'm just going to click New Chat here. This is a program, by the way, that you can sign up and use for free on the Internet. I think I'm paying either $20 or $25 a month to have the upgraded version and, earlier access. And if you were to ask me the economic value of having that, it probably just depends on who you are and what questions you have to ask. But let me tell you this. About 6 months ago, I have a chief operating officer of my company. We have a workforce of about 250 people, 125 employees, 125 independent contractors, and he is a really prolific user of ChatGPT. And I asked him, I said, Bob, if you had to choose between using ChatGPT or having 10% of the workforce, like you get ChatGPT, but you have to reduce the workforce by 10%, which do you choose, the workforce or ChatGPT? He says, I'd have to keep ChatGPT. So to him, he thinks it's worth 1 to 2 dozen people. That's a lot to sink in and something to really take into consideration for implications. So I'm going to use ChatGPT-4 here. I don't know if you guys can read this. I hope you can. But I'm just going to say, tell me about KDIS. By the way, do you pronounce it KDIS or CUDIS or KDIS? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, I typoed that, so let me tell it to stop generating. Oops, don't regenerate, stop that. Okay, this is what I get for looking on a different screen here. We're going to turn around a little bit. So far...
I've tried.
I've used my quota.
Yeah, so if you can, let me just type it over. Tell me about Katie's Kentucky. Okay, so now the human got the question typed in there properly. And let's see, I think I did. Let me go down. Okay.
There you go.
Trigg County. Can you guys read this? Mm-hmm. Now, I sometimes describe this. You remember how impressed you were with Google at some point, right? The access to information is just incredible compared to what we had before. But many of us walk around with questions in our mind, and we think, I'm not going to allocate time and energy to Google that. Because one of the challenges that you find is that virtually every opinion is represented out there, right? So it's a sea of information. So the challenge with using Google is, how do you get rid of the 99.999% of the information and just get what you want? So I sometimes describe this as having a full-time research assistant. If I type something like that into Google, oh, sure, it would give me a million articles, but I've got to try to consume that information, determine what I think is credible, distill it down and everything. And this is like telling a research assistant, hey, I need to know about Katie's? Katie's, okay.
Name possessive, like Katie's.
Katie's, yeah. So I need to know about Katie's, and saying, go spend 4 hours in Google and write me a one-page document that I can count on. Well, that's what ChatGPT does, right? So now I'm going to say, just to play with it, put that in a poem. I'm tethered to my phone. I fear. Oh, here we go. So there was no, it didn't have access to that. It generated that immediately after I asked it to, right? Now I'm going to say, put that at the third grade reading level. So when ChatGPT came out, the public reaction, the news media reaction, was a little bit amusing, I think. They were, first of all, so concerned about how are we going to teach students, because now we'll never know what was human-authored and what wasn't. And promptly over the Christmas holiday, a grad student came up with another AI that could help determine that, and I don't know how good it is. But it reminds me a little bit of being in engineering school. And when calculators got better. When I was a freshman at Rose Holman, I took calculus, like all engineering students do. And, the tests were challenging and everything. But the incoming freshmen the year later had calculators, their HP calculators, could do calculus. And so the math department was up in arms about, what are we going to do now? Because now everybody will know the answer to the test. And, of course, they still learn calculus, and it's helpful. So we will have challenges. Students submitting work done by others probably dates back to the first school, and it won't be the most challenging thing, I suppose, that comes out of this. Anybody, I want to get into some other topics, limitations. I mentioned the September 2021. That means it can't tell you how the stock market's performing this week, this month, or do a stock pick for you, things like that. So what I expect is for its root capability to improve over time and for them to shorten how out of date it is. So instead of that being whatever the distance between, a year and a half or almost 2 years, get that down to a year, get it down to 6 months, get it down to less. I think it's extraordinary the degree of productivity that this will allow knowledge workers to have. I'll tell you what we do in my company. We don't subject our customers to any raw AI. What we do is we use it to make our workers, our staff, more effective. So one of our first product is called First Draft, and it's a speech recognition program that generates health records from physician dictation all by itself, and then a medical transcriptionist that perhaps 25 years ago would have listened to that and typed it, and maybe that would have taken her 25 minutes. Now maybe she can take that first draft and accept a lot of it, replace some of it, and get it done in 7 minutes, right? It's like, I often say, it's like taking a carpenter that makes great furniture, but he's been using a handsaw his whole life, and you teach him to use a power saw, he's going to be more productive. He's probably going to earn more, he's going to make more furniture, he can probably sell it for less, and that's the role technology has played in the evolution of the human economy and culture. So this is definitely doing that already. There are a lot of concerns that companies like mine have in terms of using something like this, because naturally if you put your secrets into ChatGPT, well, you know, you don't have a right to privacy from, you know, that stuff you give them. They will use it. In fact, one of the ways that ChatGPT will get better over the next year is they built all this without having hundreds of millions of users. Now they have hundreds of millions of users typing things into it and evaluating it, and that alone will help improve it. I think it is a wonderful stroke of luck, frankly, that this technology is coming out at a time when we have record low unemployment. Because my personal assessment is, especially when it comes to knowledge worker jobs, this is impactful enough that it is going to allow companies to reduce workforces. It just is. And in many ways, that's a good thing. It's a bad thing for anybody who loses a job. But if you think about it, if our technology for farming or any other, if our automobile technology was what it was 30 years ago, for example, the car that somebody pays $50,000 today would have to cost $150,000, right? We pull cost out. If we were relying on the farming techniques that we used half a century ago, a billion people would die because there just would not be enough grain to sustain our population. So this type of thing needs to happen. The concern is the rapid pace and making sure that everybody finds a soft landing. My recommendation to anybody who does work with knowledge and so forth is that you become that carpenter that adopts the power saw. You know, add to your own productivity, your own value early on. Don't allow yourself to say, well, you know, I've always done it this old way, and become a casualty. You're going to need to adopt it. I read a book. I've got a couple more slides, but I'll narrate them. I read a book a year and a half to 2 years ago that I would recommend to anyone. And the title of the book is, and it's ironic that it came out like a year or so, or at least I read it a year or so before ChatGPT came out. The title of the book is A More Beautiful Question. And the author's premise is this. 50 years ago, the people who contributed the most to society, the people who were compensated the most, who were thought of as those to emulate, were people who had answers. People who knew things. In engineering school, oh my gosh, the memorization I needed to do, right? I had to learn how to interpolate tables, references, and all that. Here would be the point. All the answers are already out there. And much like we talked about using Google earlier, anybody can find an answer. The people in this century that are going to be valued the most, who are going to contribute to the most to society, are going to be those who figure out what questions to ask. Because you can ask Google questions. Imagine two people. Imagine two of us. Just we divided the room in half, or we took two people and we set a competition. You're each going to use Google or ChatGPT or something, and we want to know what the most creative, entertaining, most impactful thing you can come up with in 30 minutes is. Right? It would be those who ask the best questions. I don't know if you're a fan of Elon Musk or a detractor, and it doesn't really even matter, but when I think about his career and going so rapidly to the wealthiest human being on the planet or anywhere, I would have to say that he had the courage to ask really impactful questions. Why can't we make space affordable? because rockets are so dang expensive and we can't reuse them. So he built rockets that operate the way our cartoons did 50 years ago, that land themselves and can be reused, right? I'm honestly not sure with Tesla if he was primarily chasing climate change or what, but Tesla, really interesting. He was an original investor in ChatGPT, the company OpenAI that created ChatGPT. It's a little bit of a detractor of theirs now. They're mostly owned and influenced by Microsoft, which will be the opposite of open, and Microsoft is building it into their Bing search engine with limited success so far. But that book really explores the nature of a couple of things. One being what I already described, how important it is to ask great questions. Another one, I'm a fairly literal person, so another one that it explores is this. I've always thought that when somebody asks a question, it needed to be answered. A question demands an answer. And this book does a really eloquent job of explaining that questions need not be answered. They can be explored as a leaping off point for a more beautiful question, a better question. So in my company's strategic sessions that we do today, when somebody asks a question, we don't go immediately to answering the question. We brainstorm, is there a better question? Is there a better question? And we keep refining it so that at the end of a meeting, we can choose one or two or three questions for people to go out and take action on. That has been a tremendous help in shortening the cycle time for developing ideas and so forth. So with that, I've already lost a number of people. Sorry for this morning. For those of you that stayed, maybe you're polite or maybe it was okay. But let's have a dialogue. Questions, comments, thoughts?
So even with bots, survival of the fittest is the answer.
You say even with bots. I would say especially with bots.
Right.
I would suggest that human evolution is over. It has been over. I have a nephew who's 14. He was born 23 and a half weeks in utero, 1 pound, 1 ounce. Now, that's the opposite of survival of the fittest, right? We're high tech, we have high capabilities, and we're a compassionate people and culture. And so we try to protect the vulnerable, the weak, and so forth. Whereas with the bots, it is precisely that, right? You create 1 billion copies of a type of code, and you think nothing about keeping the two best and discarding the 999, you know, billion or a million of them, right? So it is exactly that. In fact, I've often wondered what Charles Darwin would think of this, because we've actually created a synthetic version.
I know the implications with education and plagiarism and things. What is sort of the standard now as far as citing your sources? Is there an expectation that you simply put from chat? How do people that are using it on a day-to-day basis now?
That's fascinating.
Like Ed, maybe with the, I don't guess the news sources can use them, can they, or can they?
Legally we can, but we should cite, and I'll just state it openly, I don't use it.
Yeah, in fact, the first casualty here, of course, is you're familiar with the writer's strike in Hollywood, right? So you can just imagine with this, we've all seen the movie or contemplated somebody who's, spent years writing a novel or a script and refining it, trying to sell it, and so forth. So I would say that it's probably professional journalists and so forth who think and worry about that type of thing a lot. I imagine that 99% or more users of ChatGPT don't even give it very much thought. But it is an interesting question, and when we go back to English common law and everything that has developed through copyrights, protections, and so forth, that was all a glacial movement that took place over centuries, and it's never been quite like this before. Now, clearly, the publishers of ChatGPT are not seeking credit. they would tell us that if they were. So they're generating the content either for free or for the $25 or something. And so the courts certainly haven't struggled with this yet to let us know where they stand. I don't think we can count on a legislature to do it, right? They haven't figured out social media 25 years later. So if they did do something, it would almost certainly be a misstep, I would think.
Be wrong.
So I'll tell you what we do. Inside our company, similar to how you'd be concerned about students, I don't want people, and most of my people work from home, I don't want people doing 20 hours of work for a 40-hour salary and just turning in that. And I should have also told you that the video mentioned this, like the dog, the bulldog dressed in a bee costume, it said it can 100% that's a bee, right? ChatGPT and all generative AI does suffer from something that is very similar to humans, and that is hallucinations. It will flat out tell you something is true, or it believes it to be true, that it made up. Yeah. And humans do that as well. And sometimes humans do it to deceive you. I don't think these ever do it for deceptive purposes, but we also, our memories are, fallible, right? So a couple things we do. We tell people, we don't threaten to fire anybody or anything, but as a company policy, it is unacceptable to turn over AI-generated content as a work product. You can use it, like let's say, for example, my people in marketing. We say, hey, we're coming up with this new product. It's going to have a couple of features, and we want to develop a marketing plan for it. Well, you can put that right into ChatGPT, and it'll generate you a 30-page marketing plan, right? But that doesn't mean it would be a great product. What it means, it's what I would call a first draft. It's like, oh, I wouldn't even thought to put a section in about this, and that's great. And it didn't cover this, and I think we should. So it could be an accelerator, but it's soft clay. It ought to be a contribution, not something finished. Here's the other thing that we do. We tell them for any important work product that you develop where AI contributed, we want you to record and save the prompt. The prompt is what we type in. Tell me about Katie's Kentucky. And the reason why is that the better the prompt, the more beautiful question, the better the output. And ChatGPT is now on version 4. Well, it'll be on version 5, version 6 in a year or something. We could run those same prompts back through a newer version and get even better content, as well as refine the prompt itself. Make sense? What else?
So I'm going to go the Skynet route.
Yeah, sure.
So they say, like, when they're coding these bots and they're doing different rules, but what about boundaries? Do they put boundaries on how far the bots can go?
Yes, they do. The video mentioned, for example, what 8 videos would be good to show you next, mm-hmm. and what videos should not be allowed to be on the site at all, for example. And so if you were to go to ChatGPT and ask it some, I don't know what it does with obscenity, frankly, but if you were to ask it, how do I make a Molotov cocktail? I'd like to blow up a police car. It's got boundaries built in for that. It'll say that, I don't remember how it responds, but it explains to you that that's out of bounds. That's right. But it knows it, right? It does know, because that's all. It's information that's out there.
Right.
Yeah. So, good question. And, the little AI bots that I made are task-specific and so forth. The generative AI is so much more broad, but I don't really see, and I mean that literally, like I'm not saying it couldn't, I don't see the leap from that to Skynet.
The Terminator,
where AI takes over and decides that.
Okay.
You can say the same thing. With
okay. I was with you.
I got it out.
Ultron went on the internet, decided that people were bad.
That's right. We're destroying the planet. We hurt each other and so forth.
Because the input was, what do we do to save the planet?
Oh, I've been looking at that clock thinking we had plenty of time for
no.
I thought, boy, that is really nice. So sorry about
the
that.
The Ultron was, how do we save the planet? How do we put us, you know, well, to save the planet, we get rid of you.
Yeah.
And that was his, you know, that was his input. And that
was a beautiful outcome. Question.
Yeah, I got to say, this has been very interesting.
Yeah, this is
great. My total knowledge of AI I got from Carmilla Harris.
That's scary.
It's too late.
Did she say okay. that right after Al Gore invented the internet?
Right after that.
It's two letters. A.
It's definitely not what I learned in college.
You know, he talks about elimination of jobs. We're using this already some in our company to give us creative writing block. We're using it to write to give people to rewrite press releases. But it's going to be a key element in our WBKT radio station that we're launching, because we're meeting some students there. They already know more about it than we do. So I see it, and this is just the eternal optimist in me, and that's just the way I think. Rather than thinking about ways that it's going to eliminate things, I'm thinking about a way to save things, a way to make things better, a way to strengthen things that we don't have the people, personnel, manpower, money to build. Instead, I can build a really great product on a subpar product now using some artificial intelligence. So my mind is working more on how to make a whole lot of things better without having to spend the cost of human, you know, interaction.
That's what we're doing as well. I would just say that all technology through time has been a double-edged sword.
It's,
right?
Right, yeah, for sure.
We have to
you know, AI is not going to write the way Ed Marlowe writes. His career is very safe for us. But AI is going to write a media release that someone wrote me that wasn't well done to begin with, and we rewrite it.
That's true.
So, you know, and then he's not spending time on media releases, rewriting, which is our requirement. That's what we require as a company. You cannot use a media release as submitted.
Right.
So instead of him spending time on that, he's spending time on a deep-level story about the history of Katie's Baptist Church and how that's going to impact downtown Katie's.
Sure.
So,
and eventually that content will become knowledge consumed by generative AI. And then we'll have to figure out, you know, what it's allowed access to, if it has the site, and so forth. But just one quick thing on authorship. It's fascinating. If any of you are familiar with the author Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life, he's a prolific author and college professor. He said that to test ChatGPT, and as a testament to it, he had something coming up where he needed to submit a paper and give a talk on something that he hadn't written about. And he asked ChatGPT if it was familiar with his works, his books and stuff, and it said, yeah, of course. And he said, write me a 4-page paper on this topic in my voice, based on what you know about me. And he said that it was new content for me. He said, that paper I wrote, if I had had amnesia, like woke up in the hospital and you told me that I had written that the day prior, I'd believe you. He said, I told it to use a certain type of English, and, you know, and he said,
it's crazy.
He said, I believe I could have written that content. Now, of course, there's a lot of his writing out there.
We have it mimicking our voices now, so that if the ad needed to be changed from 10 to 3 instead of 10 to 4, they can go in there and plug in my voice, change it to the word green. It's really hard to detect. If you didn't like have a really skilled ear, you would not know that that's different than me saying green.
To think about where that's going, deep fakes now.
Oh yeah,
that's so scary. Right. So the fact, you know, do not believe your lying eyes. The fact that somebody shows you a video of the president saying something or whatever, that is no longer reliable.
Best that I got to go.
And sometimes to remind myself where we are on this journey, I think back to Ross Perot. What was that, 92? He was running for president against former President Bush and Bill Clinton. And arguably, he threw the election to Clinton. Mm-hmm. But you may remember that he had been in the race, that he bailed out of the race and rejoined in the fall. And he revealed that the reason that he had bailed out of the race in the spring was that the Republican dirty tricksters had shown him a photograph of his daughter having sex with two other people in college. And they had threatened to release it if he did. Now, I don't mean to, the salacious part of this is not the reason I'm saying it, But a billionaire dropped out of a presidential election because somebody had a photograph. Today, they could show her with three eyes, you know, landing on the moon, right? Like, nobody would believe a photograph in this Photoshop era. And we're getting to the point where video has to be the same. So it's a fascinating journey that we've taken in our lifetimes about content, believability.
I'm just deeply concerned about originality. That's probably my biggest concern. Copyright will sort itself out, but originality. ChatGPT doesn't exist unless someone prior created it. So I know it can create its own algorithm and it starts to build. Yeah. And the English language exists because we built it.
Agreed.
So that's a concern for
me. So like my 12-year-old, that's his favorite game to play on ChatGPT because he doesn't use it for anything useful. He likes to write stories through ChatGPT.
Didn't I hear recently that these computers are starting to use language that we don't understand? Talking to each other. They've created their own language now.
In addition, there have been some surprises. The hallucinations are a concern, a surprise. But when Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, was on 60 Minutes 30 to 60 days ago, and they asked him some of the strengths, weaknesses, he pointed out, I forget what language it is, but there's a language that is used by a very small number of people. And they were surprised that ChatGPT figured out that language. There isn't that much written about it. It had very little access to information, but it was able to communicate in that language.
Farsi?
Farsi is actually a pretty big language.
Yeah, it's true.
It's big enough.
I think it's smaller than that, yeah. But, there are some really fascinating things like that that are kind of unexpected.
Probably an African tribe type country or a language or something where there's only very few people using it.
Yeah, so I would just kind of close with, we all have opinions about what we can use it for, what's exciting and so forth, what we're concerned about. And like anything else in our society, we can voice those opinions or take action, political or otherwise. But this train has left the station. I mean, humanity is, this might sound alarmist, but another book I really enjoyed about 5 years ago was called Sapiens. And it describes basically everything from the origin of the universe to where we are today. And that author makes a credible assertion that history is ending and changing to something else. Because the definition of history is a study of human culture. And human culture that existed 50 years ago was unadulterated. It was human culture. Today, with prostheses, with access to information systems, the ability for things to live on, and you'll actually need to go to the rainforest or find tribes or something to study humans that are not affected or supplanted, from prostheses to thinking. You know, one of Elon Musk's company, I forget the name of it, Neuralink, is working on a way to plug into your spinal cord so that you're not limited to your five senses in communicating with a computer or the internet. Now, that will be a radical departure from humanity when we have a wire through which we can communicate with computers or wireless, whatever, it doesn't matter. But if we break through and are able to create a sixth sense, something that is much faster, much more capable.
Just the Matrix.
Yeah.
But is that not that?
It might all just be a simulation.
Absolutely.